Discussions of the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. often focus on some of his triumphs of the mid-60s, triumphs like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But Dr. King's last campaign was a direct challenge to elements of the American economic system. In the last year of his life, Dr. King led the Poor People's Campaign of 1968. On the phone to help us understand what Dr. King was trying to accomplish and the challenges that he was facing is Professor Allison Mitchell of the Department of Africana Studies and American Studies at Notre Dame. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you all for having me.
And thanks for joining us. So, why did Dr. King's focus turn to economic issues in the mid-1960s?
So this is an interesting question because in many ways, economic issues were always kind of at the center of the movement. Many of the people that he's working with and organizing with are people of different class dynamics, right? So what we see with King is not necessarily his idea of economic justice just starting, but he's responding to the movement around him. There's some really good people. Thomas F. Jackson has a really good book on him. Where he talks about, like, in the mid-1960s, it was more overt because economic problems became more overt, right? So he's not a product of changing the movement. Rather, the movement changed him. So how do you respond to the urban crisis? How do you respond to white flight and deindustrialization in cities, right? A lot of these problems were not solved, right? The economic disparity in the South still existed. And it kind of even more became more exacerbated with the Vietnam War and how much spending was there, many of which were Black people and Black soldiers being sent who were poor and working class and dying at a disproportionate rate, right? So all of these things are happening around him. We've had great legislation thus far, as we see in 1964 and 65, but this economic question isn't answered. And so he is now kind of called upon, based on the circumstances around him and the rest of the people moving along with him, to answer that question.
So kind of to oversimplify it, the legislation purportedly was going to open doors. And
right. So
go ahead.
Without question, it did. We know 1964. We know what the Civil Rights Act did. Right. There was like the idea of racial inequality in different ways and dealing with discrimination at a legal standpoint. That is great work. The Voting Rights Act. So many barriers were dropped because of the Voting Rights Act. And that's not to say that these were not exceptional. Right. But they still couldn't answer some of those robust questions of economic inequality. So if you're a working class person, right, you can fight legally against discrimination, right? You can argue for your right to the ballot. But what happens when you're dealing with unequal housing? What happens when you're dealing with the struggle for jobs, right? And also, too, you're witnessing in a current moment, you're questioning government spending in different ways. And the War on Poverty by Johnson is supposed to kind of alleviate all of this. So if you're not feeling it now, you're asking these questions.
So now, why do you think popular history often stops after 1965, you know, the Voting Rights Act, effectively sanitizing Dr. Martin Luther King's later, more radical focus on the redistribution of economic power?
So I feel like this has a two-part answer, right? On the first part, right, we acknowledge that some of this is a creation of a narrative of him, right? MLK Day, as we celebrate it, also the MLK Day of Service, which is what it's initially intended by his wife, Coretta Scott, when she's pushing for it, is also something that's written into law during the Reagan administration, who has a different idea of economics than him, right? And even as we move forward with other politicians and well into our contemporary moment, a lot of times we do pull from certain entities of his life, right, that are very important. The multicultural aspect of his work, the interfaith aspect of his work, the nonviolent aspects of the movement that he helped shift and create. And many of those great successes kind of, for some, stop in 1965 because we don't see the Poor People's Campaign as being successful, right? And so this narrative kind of gets woven into our contemporary understanding of him. And, you know, I think in addition to that, there is kind of this kind of scholarly argument that some of us have, right, where Julian Bond was an activist in that time. He later was a state legislator in Georgia, and he actually was a professor at the University of Virginia. He calls the question the master narrative, right? Which is a narrative that starts with the bus boycott or Brown v. Board, and it goes up into this 1965, sometimes 68. And it centers on people like King, and it centers on leaders, particularly men, And while many people have pushed to start looking at the local and the grassroots, and that's kind of what he's kind of foregrounding, that kind of legacy of triumphed history is one that we still kind of struggle with, right? Because we want to look at the clear successes, but not wrestle with the potential that some other aspects had. And the Poor People's Campaign had so much potential.
And that sort of takes us to a natural segue, which is, again, popular culture. What did we learn in school? That the techniques for the Montgomery bus boycott, I mean, it was linear, right? We're not going to ride the bus. Things happened. The Selma March. Those are all sort of, you can see the cause and effect. How did Dr. King visualize the techniques that he would use for the Poor People's Campaign?
So these techniques kind of bridge all of those previous ones. I always like to talk to people about the bus boycott sometimes. Because who's riding the bus?
Yeah.
Right? Who's riding the bus? What's at the core of this? It's a financial issue. I'm spending money on this service that I can't use. Also, one of their later calls is not only fair treatment, but many of them want Black bus drivers because they know that that's actually a very good job, one that is afforded to a certain white middle class, right? Certain jobs that we now call different names, that was a very good job in that moment. So even then, people are still thinking about that kind of this idea of the financial situation and economic issues. But what he sees with the Poor People's Campaign is not only a product of this growth, but they sit down and talk about it in 1967. So they do a five-day retreat, right? Which I think is also a lot of times when we talk about activism, people, they have retreats, they sit down, they organize. And the goal was going to be to kind of put American poverty on blast for everyone to see. We see that with marches, right? It was going to be a multicultural group. It's going to be held at the National Mall, which has so much significance to the movement, right? That's where the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was in 1964. That's where one of his other talks, the Prayer for Pilgrims in 1957, right after, I think it was like the 3-year anniversary of Brown v. Board, right? So this is a place that we all know and one that we're all familiar with. And so he wanted to bring people back there to that place. And in that moment, rather than have a march and speeches, they were going to create a shanty town, which we know is usually the idea of a cup of cardboard and different things, kind of building a little community. And it was supposed to demonstrate to the government, but also the world, like putting this idea of poverty on blast and having the people be a part of it. So encouraging working class people to help build what would be Resurrection City. And this was not something that they created out of thin air. They actually pulled from the Bonus March in 1932, where World War I veterans actually camped out in a similar space and were calling for their veteran bonuses that they were owed. So it's a mix of strategies, and also them too as activists and King as well, reflecting on history and how do we deal with, and how do we kind of push the government to move forward with some of the decisions, particularly legislation that we're calling for. So, and that's the big thing, right? It's legislation.
I was going to say, we started by talking about techniques. Let's sort of bring into focus objectives. What did he want to do?
They wanted an economic bill of rights. That's what they wanted more than anything. And what that was going to have, what they hoped to have, was clearly defined answers to what would be this newer version of the war on poverty. They wanted Congress to pass legislation dealing with employment. They wanted guaranteed income. They also wanted the construction of affordable housing. And so these are initiatives that we have heard before, but they wanted something large, just as big as these other bills that they've seen, and they know that can be done, right? And they also, when they talked about numbers, one of their critiques was because of, okay, well, if we're spending so much here on military service, we could also take some of this same type of financial investment, and if we invest it into these clear policies, then we can really deal with poverty in the U.S. And not just poverty in a Black and white, right, but poverty of the larger group of the United States, because disparity doesn't necessarily have a color, right?
Yeah. So, speaking of that, so the Poor People's Campaign was a multiracial coalition uniting Black, brown, indigenous, poor white Americans. From a scholarly perspective, What were the primary internal frictions in building such a diverse class-based front?
Well, I think it was one, they had to deal with like the kind of local, right? What makes King different than some other activists is his activism went across the U.S. So how is he dealing with the local ideas of poverty, many of which at times are very racialized, right, in the South versus the North or the West? How do you answer this overarching question for people with different experience and different community engagement? Right. I think the first challenge for him was when he first left the South and really started organizing elsewhere. Chicago was one of his biggest challenges in 1996. And by this point, they're already kind of developing this idea of the Poor People's Campaign, because before that, it was a question of housing. Right. They're already there. And so how do you deal with like housing discrimination, job discrimination that's coming out in different ways? That has kind of a racial undertone, but also there are class divisions, right? It's not simply just a coalition of people of different colors, but people of different classes. Because there is a Black middle class in several spaces who take on a similar idea of like not being a fan of the word welfare, right? It has that kind of derogatory term for them too. So like, I think for first and foremost, he and as well as SCLC knew that that was gonna be their biggest challenge, is kind of getting these groups together. But in a way, they were successful because the goal was to have different people from different communities willing to deal with poverty. And you see in some of the early developments of organizing around this, there's various union groups. Some of them come from New Jersey, New Mexico, Kentucky, California, right? These are different people. We later see he goes down to Memphis. And so you have this idea, like the potential for a great movement is there. And recognizing a lot of it is dealing with workers are going to kind of be that entry point for most of it.
So the notion was, we're going to create visibility, we're going to build this coalition that will include, you know, multiracial and recruiting people like unions. Were there any legislators, was there any that were showing sympathy toward this that sort of gave them hope, either legislators or, you know, officials in the Johnson administration that were sympathetic to some of these things?
I would say yes. I think realistically, there was more of a push and pull in the question, the push and pull in the question of what King and others were asking for versus what the Johnson administration felt they were doing. Like, I know I've referenced the war on poverty a lot, but from their administrative standpoint, they saw themselves as making these differences in negotiations. Even at times, like Johnson would critique Congress when they weren't as supportive of certain things. And so he had allies. But I think the biggest part about understanding civil rights, not even as a moment, but just as an actual like thing that we work around, is everyone's idea of a solution can be very, very different and competing. And so I would say this, I definitely feel like he did have significant help. I mean, there were sometimes, especially the work when done and actually in DC after he is assassinated and they kind of still are trying to engage this campaign, right? There are different groups and communities still willing to engage with them.
Yeah. So a moment ago, you mentioned Memphis and what was going on in Memphis at that time that led Dr. King to travel to Memphis, where he was ultimately killed.
Right. So as I referenced, Memphis and other groups, unions and workers were a big part of this Poor People's Campaign, particularly because these were people also who were working, but understood they needed better working conditions. And so the Black sanitation workers in Memphis were on strike. They were calling for better pay, better hours. You know, they dealt with unfair firings and different poor work conditions. They were working long hours, but still living relatively destitute. So they knew the disparity was significant. And so King is invited there by another activist, James Lawson, another former student activist, later turned professor, right? The goal is for King to not only join the front lines and march with them. And so King agrees to do that. And we see a lot of very good imagery from that moment too, the I Am a Man pictures that we see everywhere, very iconic, right? And so King and SCLC see this as a part of, and honestly a catalyst for what they're kind of going forward with, which is going to be the Resurrection City, right? So dealing with and kind of pulling other people from the local to this bigger movement they want to have in DC. And so he goes there and he organizes with them and he does participate in a march. And it's while there that he's assassinated.
And you mentioned, a couple times you've mentioned the SCLC, which just for our listeners, that is the Southern Christian Leadership Conference that he was leading.
Yes.
So everything was oriented toward planning Resurrection City. When was that supposed to take place as of the time of the assassination?
So if my understanding is correctly, he was assassinated in April, and they began building, I want to say, in May.
Was he already thinking about it for later that
year? Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. They were already thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
They were already thinking about it.
So the sanitation workers were kind of the first group, were the sanitation workers, what was it, like 15,000 of them were on strike in Memphis? And were they going to be the beginning of Resurrection City and then other cities where they could strike? And then since they're striking, they can go to help build Resurrection City?
So at this point, even when he went to Memphis, they'd already had meetings in Atlanta where other union groups and different people had came and shown up. So him going to Memphis was a part of this launching, but there are other groups who are already ready to go, which is why even after his assassination, like, this campaign doesn't just go away, right? It's because it was already in motion. And he was a part of the SCLC, or the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was a very long, it was a longstanding group at this point, right? With several people who had influences who worked with him.
Okay, so things are underway. The plans are going for this Resurrection City. And how was the SCLC, after the assassination, and obviously there was undoubtedly a lot of shock and horror, but how did the SCLC pull itself together to try to carry on with this kind of operation in Resurrection City?
Well, I think they were able to work with the groups that they were already engaging with. The real question is, they struggled with the idea, and they had to get permits and stuff too, right? This is something they couldn't just simply go there. Like, all this was structured, right? So they still pulled this together while also kind of just wrestling with what felt like, for many people across the U.S., an absence. I think that goes into the why we deem this as an unsuccessful movement. Because they still had the same orchestration. They still had community groups. Like, a lot of student organizers came as well. They had met with people in different groups, New York, et cetera, already before this. So some of them were still willing to come. But the real issue wasn't necessarily the permits and the different. The real issue was convincing people to still galvanize around this in spite of Martin Luther King Jr. not being a part of it.
And they did build a Resurrection City. I mean, there are pictures, iconic pictures of those buildings, those shanty buildings around the mall.
Yeah, I mean, they did it. And I think, again, like, when we talk about the significance of this movement, and did it become truly what Martin Luther King Jr. wanted, right? Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wanted. I argue that I don't see this as a defeat. Right? Because to me, the idea of a defeat is to suggest that they did not put what they truly believed on the front, right? They still did these things. They went forward with it, right? It was very costly, right? The group was smaller. And they didn't get they wanted way more attention from the Johnson administration than they got. I think also it's important to note that after King's assassination, the Housing Act of 1968 is signed in April, right? So some people are thinking, well, we've gotten some form of, it's not the full economic rights, but it's a part of it, right? Housing was a part of it. But I don't see this as a defeat, right? Because in the end, the goal was to create this coalition. It was to stand up for their rights. A lot of poor and working class people came from various places. They have a lot of good materials and people talking about their experience coming from Alabama, Mississippi, et cetera, as well as the North. And they resurrected these cities, and they stood there as long as they could. They dealt with also terrible weather and still managed. If you look at those pictures, you see it's muddy. Yeah. They dealt with terrible weather, but they still were determined to kind of demand not only rights, but also just demand respect, right? And I think respect, and I respect them, and I show admiration towards them.
You know, you mentioned the housing bill, but to what extent do you think that the PPC, the Poor People's Campaign, led to significant policy changes at the federal level? I mean, they had a huge ambition. And you said it wasn't really a failure, but what did they get done? I mean, other than that housing bill that you mentioned.
So that's a tricky one.
Yep.
It's a very tricky question. Because a lot of the responses they received were, I don't want to use the term ignored, but a lot of the concern that came around their work and effort came with the concern of potential violence, because after King's assassination, there were so much rioting in urban spaces. Mm-hmm. So a lot of their engagement, particularly with the federal government and the local in the DC, was this concern of whether or not there was going to be some type of violent interaction. But I personally feel that because at the end of the day, this poor people's, I feel this way based on my own reading of this material, is that the Poor People's Campaign was Resurrection City, but it was a larger movement. Right. And I actually envelope the Housing Act into that, because I do feel like the larger movement of what they were getting at was a question of housing, but also economic inequality more broadly. So I'm hoping that answers your question.
No, it does.
But I do feel like that's the one, right? But I also think, too, as we think about this movement and we think about civil rights, we have to be very clear with what their goals were. And their goals always went beyond just the major legislative. There was always, they wanted more critical day-to-day change, right?
Yeah, and what's interesting is that, you know, as you talk about, when you look back at some of the things that Dr. King complained about or observed, and you think about current economic conditions, many of the things he was talking about are still very much with us today.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting because I think not only are we dealing with housing, I think there is a question of, one of the groups that came were women workers, right? A lot of that was the idea of the working class woman and seeking childcare. You know, I'm at work, I need somewhere for my child to go, and they're not K-12 age. So there were a lot of these things that we still hear people discussing now. And I think that's important as well, because we know that not only do these issues still exist, but the Poor People's Campaign still exists, right? In 2018, 2019, the Poor People's Campaign, the name is also the National Call for Moral Revival, is a group that still works in the U.S. today with people who sit with these principles and have been engaging since then throughout the various protest movements and given speeches and have held conversations with those in Congress and et cetera, right? So I think the way to really look at this legacy is, one, acknowledging that these issues are still here, but acknowledging too that what they put forth in 1968 is something that people are still pushing for today and willing to do and work in the same confines, right? It's the same push for economic inequality in this kind of multicultural setting.
Now, how many people were in Resurrection City when they put it together? Was that about 5,000?
I want to say roughly 5,000.
Yeah. And how long did Resurrection City last until the administration had the police come in and tear it down?
Do I have the exact number? I want to say May to June. Because to my knowledge, it was only so many weeks.
Yeah.
It wasn't incredibly long.
Yeah. And how did they get the people to live? So this was always my very, very curious to figure out how they got the people out of Resurrection City so that they could go in there and tear it down. How did they lure them out, if you will?
Well, I don't necessarily know they had to lure them. I think it also just became kind of exhausting.
Yeah.
I think it honestly just became exhausting. And I think that once they were able to get some support, right? Some local support as well. But I think it became kind of clear that they weren't going to necessarily get what they were intending. And also, again, it was very costly. And so I feel like they were already kind of being policed the entire time. It's almost like folks were wear down.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess a lot of harassment from different people around might have started trickling out. Going back home.
Okay, it seems like this was a particularly good day to spend time with Professor Allison Mitchell, reflecting on the Poor People's Campaign of 1968. Before we go, Professor Mitchell, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I just want to say, I think as we go into Dr. Martin Luther King Day and we think about his legacy, a good important part of that is to think about his legacy in full, right, in total. And this is a part of it. Even after his assassination, the things that he dreamed about, if I dare say, continue to motivate people. And the Poor People's Campaign, I think, is a prime example of that. A movement that he started that people were determined through struggle to still see it through.
Okay, we've spent a few minutes talking to Professor Allison Mitchell of Notre Dame about the last campaign of Dr. Martin Luther King, the Poor People's Campaign, its significance and its legacy. Thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this.